You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
At LV, our car insurance comes from the heart. That's why we've just launched our new multi-car cover. One policy and one renewal date means it's one simple way for you to save on your family's cars. So just imagine how much you can save by insuring 2, 3, or even more cars with us. To get your exclusive multi-car discount from the Which Insurance Provider of the Year 2017, go direct to lv.com. T's and C's apply.
Ladies and gentlemen. Podcasting since 2005. You are listening to Gamer Tag Radio. With your hosts, Godfrey, Pete Rock, Paris, Pasta.
Welcome to Gamer Tag Radio, episode 478. This is your host, Godfrey, and this week we have Paris. What's going on, Paris?
It's good, man. I'm excited. The interview that we got this week, very excited about it. So what's going on with you?
Man, it got me hype.
Oh, yeah.
For the
Absolutely.
Game. Can we say what it is? Because I believe people are listening. Like,
let's just let them guess. It was just all of a sudden they'll just come on and they'll figure it out. No, I mean, we're talking about The Witcher 3. We got a chance to sit down with those guys over at CD Projekt Red. Had a great time. And I think it was a really good interview. What did it come out to? About 45, 50 minutes, something like that?
So far, I think it's around, between 45, 50 minutes long. I mean, that's a pretty long conversation about one game.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and the reason why I think the vibe between us and them, the developers, remember, they're like in somewhere else. We recorded this really, really early. I believe 10 a.m. my time, 7 a.m. your time.
Right, yeah, because they're over in Poland, which I think it was 4 p.m. their time when we did it. But yeah, I think it came out pretty well. And again, just want to thank those guys, Miles and Jonas, who are on the development team for The Witcher 3, and Robert, who's their community manager over there. They really took care of us, so I appreciate that.
Definitely. And Tom, too.
That goes without saying.
Really cool. Yeah, dude, I just love the vibe between our conversation. You guys that are listening are going to enjoy this, and I'm definitely for sure you're going to be pretty hype about the game even more after this interview. So very quick, head over to gamertagradio.com or play.it to listen to our past episodes, and make sure to share it to your friends, Twitter, Facebook, subscribe on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher. Just make sure to review us and spread the word. The more you do that, it will help us get more listeners and all that, man. So, and also give us a call at 786-273-7GTR. That's 786-273-7GTR. Email us fanmail@gamertagradio.com. I believe we have a couple emails that we're going to read and voicemail for this week's episode. We're going to play that after the interview. All right, so we're going to play the interview right now. And once we come back, fan mail. So make sure to tune in for that. Here you go. The interview with CD Projekt Red about The Witcher 3.
This is a Gamer Tag Radio exclusive.
Welcome to Gamer Tag Radio. And we have Paris this week. What's up, man?
Hey, what's going on?
I believe we have a special interview for this week with the developers of The Witcher 3 Wild Hunt, which we've been excited for this game for a very long time. I think since 2 years ago at E3, right?
Yeah, at the E3, the Xbox press conference at E3, we've been very excited for this game. But let's just jump right into this. So we got the guys here. Can you go ahead and introduce yourselves?
Hi there. My name is Jonas Madsen, and I'm a senior environment artist.
Hello, I'm Miles Toss, and I'm a level designer on Witcher Wild Hunt.
Hey, thank you guys for joining us. We really appreciate this. So I'm just going to jump right into it. I'll say first and foremost, I've played The Witcher 2 Enhanced Edition, but I really want to tackle this from the standpoint of people that have not played The Witcher at all, that are brand new to the franchise. So with that said, is this a great entry point into the Witcher in Witcher franchise, or should people actually go back and read some of the source material or even go back and play the Witcher 1 and 2?
I think it's actually, I might even say it's the best point to start at, because we really kind of focused when making this game on actually introducing new players to it. Because, you know, you have to understand, we're well aware of, you know, releasing on a new platform like the PS4, for example, or the Xbox for that matter, that many people that came from those platforms, they weren't able to play our games before. So we know that we will have lots and lots of new players. And having that in mind, we designed a very, very intricate, I would say, introductory experience to the game that should allow players to, you know, be eased into the world, not only the game mechanics, but also the story, the universe. What is it about that you're doing? Why are you doing it? What's the world about? You know, what the situation is? There's war and all of that stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, you can walk into a store, you can see the game on the shelf, you can know nothing about it and just buy straight there and go home and start playing it without any problems. It's a very smooth introduction.
Well, allow me this follow-up then. Let me ask, what is a Witcher and what is the Wild Hunt?
Well, a Witcher is a kind of a monster slayer for hire, a kind of mercenary, often considered to be kind of an outcast of society. They're needed, but people don't like to hire them because they've been mutated to become extra fast, extra strength, and so on. So they're not considered to be quite humans, so not very popular in society.
Yeah, at the same time, basically these monster hunters are needed because the world of The Witcher is basically riddled with all kinds of monsters which pose a threat to the average person. And as such, these people often come together. Like, they can be regular villagers. They might even be royalty. And whenever they have a monster problem, they will spend money and hire you. And that's where you come in as a player.
You know, I play the past Witcher games, and, you know, this seems like the world is really, really big and open. Like, how big it is compared to, like, the past Witcher games, open world-wise?
Wow, that's a good question. I think we spend a few times trying to measure it, and it's really hard to talk about the size without actually mentioning the quality, because, you know, we want to make sure that it's not just a big world, it's a big world filled with lots of things to do. And the reason why it has such a big world as well is because the story needs it. So in terms of comparing it to the previous games, what's the official one we tend to give? It's 35, I think, 35 times.
Yeah, I think that's what we say.
Yeah.
That was our last measure, but
35 times compared to Witcher 2?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I just passed out of my chair. That's insane. That's amazing.
Measure again, because, like, think about it. How do you count locations that are essentially double? We have many locations in the game that are actually altered by the player's choices. So you might have a village that in one version of the game is basically burnt down, and another, they do different things there. Like, your choices affect how this village's future is actually affected. So how do you count a location like that, that is fundamentally different from one state to the other, or even has three different states?
Yeah, and, you know, add to that all the layers of exploration you can do, like the sewers, the caves, and so on. So it becomes quite tricky to know the exact number. All we know is it's very big.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, this world is so big, and, like, how long it took for you guys to develop this game?
Just about over 3 years now, yeah. I would say. But it's also about having good tools and not just the will to do it, but you got to have the right tool set to do it. So, you know, our programmers have helped us greatly to speed up the process of the development of The Wild Hunt. You know, so it's been a lot of hard work and a lot of handcrafting in the world. You'd be surprised, actually, how much handcrafted, because you sometimes when you have an open world, you think, oh, it's all generic. But really, we spent so much time making that perfect forest path, the view here, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's quite, quite a large amount of work, but
arguably you could say we spend too much on it in a way, but we think it's worth it because there's now, as a result of this process of handcrafting, there's now so much detail for the player to find in the world. And with handcrafting, what we mean is literally like every tree and rock or even house, like whatever you see, it's actually placed by hand on the level by a very loving and caring designer or artist. And again, this results in like having lots of, because Jonas and I, when we were working in the engine, we would make a location and try to put like our different of food on a table or the arrangement of a crime scene, where basically if you look at it, you can kind of go all Sherlock Holmes and deduct what happened in this place. So there's lots of these different kinds of stories and details for the player to find.
Yeah, I mean, it's very important for us that even if there's no quest going on, there's still, you can tell a story with the landscape, with the scene, what you're seeing there. So that has gone, that kind of thinking has affected us a lot when creating this game.
Yeah, it makes the world feel very rich.
Yeah.
Well, you guys have, in the last few weeks, I've seen a lot of information come out about in the environment where you're, like you've already talked about, your choices matter. I mean, the endings can change depending on the type of choices you make, both good and bad. But talk some about the fact, like, there's wildlife in the environment that you could randomly kill. There's bandits that may be in a village that if you clear them out, villagers will come back into the town, those type of things. Talk about how some of those changes just affect everything that happened in the game in so much. Like, I'll just take the example again. If you kill a bandit in a town, some of just the things that could happen, people could come back, it could attract monsters, things of that nature.
All right. Yeah, it's a difficult question because we have it in so many different scales. You might have a situation where, let's say you find yourself in a tavern attacked by or in the company of some bandits, and you don't know whether these guys are friendly or not. And now you get to make the choice: do you want to kill them or not? Because they kind of start talking to you, being the outcast monster hunter kind of guy. And depending on whether you kill them or not, way later on in the game, a path might be open for you or not. Right? So you might find an NPC that goes, "All right, here, go through this gate." But in the other version, if you had killed the bandits, he'll say, "Oh yeah, but you killed my mate. I don't know. I don't want to let you through." So now you have to actually go and find another way into wherever it is that you're going. So that's one way where how your choices can actually affect gameplay and the story that you have. On the other hand, speaking of locations, as you said, yeah, we'll have situations where you might find a village that is overrun by monsters, and you can go in and clear these villages of their monster problem. And you'll find that later when you come back, people have moved in, settled in, opened up shops, and that actually enables you to now have a new trading post, if you will. Mind you, that in the game, the way it's presented, these are not quests. Literally for you, what you see as a player is like, oh, there's monsters in this abandoned village. So you go kill it. And if you so happen to stumble back into it, you will notice that, oh, now there's a change. The game doesn't tell you, guys, there's a change here. You know, it's something that we do so the player always is out to come back to location and see how his choices actually affects the place.
Well, depending on the choices that you make in the game, is that also going to affect the side quests? Like some will unlock, some won't, based on the choices?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but again, we don't want to have a clear distinction between main quest, side quest, monster quest, and so on. It's rather one large experience that all blends in together, and it makes it more immersive when you play the game. So the side quest has some impact on main quest and vice versa, absolutely. And there's, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's so much content, and our quest designers have done an excellent job of it, really making this whole nice blend.
Yeah, we had some people in the studio the other day to play the game, and we actually asked some of them, like, "Ah, why are you not playing the main quest? Are you more interested in the side quest content?" And the person was like, "Ah, really? I'm not playing the main quest. This felt like the main quest to me because they kind of blend into each other very naturally. So the side quest content you get will actually relate in story to the main quest. So you might have like a character that you just got to know, and now you get the chance in the side quest to explore his story a bit more, but it's not necessary for you to progress. However, if you actually learn more about him or not, that will actually change your relationship to the character later on. That can have some dramatic consequences in the game. Mind you though that not all of these side quests are like that. They're not all necessarily connected to main quests. So you get these side quests that are their own
a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
We don't want to have repetition, same type of quests over and over again. We want to have a great variation so the player doesn't know really what to expect when they are experiencing our game.
Yeah, that's actually something I personally find really cool, is that our game doesn't tell you whenever a choice is important. It doesn't tell you, all right, check out this thing. You need to really focus on this because this will be the main thing that affects your ending or something. It doesn't tell you anything like that. It's often the choices that you do, you will only later know that, oh, this is what I did and this resulted in this way. That's something I never saw coming. And it will be, as Jonas said, very unexpected for the player. I think that's a really cool thing.
And it's the same thing, like when it's daytime and nighttime, there will be quests, especially only for nighttime, right?
Yeah, it depends on the kind of quests. Like some of the quests, depending on the narrative, really, they're available to you independently from the time of day. But definitely some NPCs will not hang out for you day and night waiting for you. Or maybe the certain kind of monster that you're about to hunt only comes out at a certain time of day. So definitely our time of day has an effect not only on how people live in the world or react in the world, but also on how quests are delivered.
I want to get back to monster hunting in just a second, but I want to touch on this one topic before I forget. So with the leveling system, there's been a lot of talk here in the last week or so about higher level weapons and gear permanently scaling down to whatever your current level is when you find that particular item. Can you talk about why that decision was made?
Can you enlighten me on what you've heard?
Okay, this was, I was watching, I believe it was Damien. He was on Game Trailers Live. He did an interview. And one of the questions came up about weapons in that, say you're a level 15 and you find a level 25 weapon, that weapon will scale down to your current level of 15, but it will permanently stay at that level. It won't scale back up to what it could have been if you found it later when you're at a higher level.
All right. And it's actually not our area.
Okay. That's fine. It's just I caught on to that and I was really curious what went into that decision. So I figured I'd ask.
I play this game, but honestly, when my playthroughs, I haven't really paid attention to these kind of things. I wouldn't go out on a limb here, but I'm pretty sure it only applies to, like, it doesn't apply to like ultimate weapons kind of thing. It's
okay.
Where a sword you'll find will be on your level.
Well, can you kind of talk about the difference then between ultimate weapons and just regular weapons, I guess? So I can understand the difference?
About quality level. So you get like rarer items that are more rare or unique even versus items that are more generic, like your basic soldier's sword or whatever.
Okay. Well, let's go back into monsters for a second. First, you know, we've been talking a lot about quests. So I understand that there are dungeons in the game. Now, are these only quest driven or is this something that can be found randomly as you explore through the environment?
They can be found randomly as you explore the environment. Absolutely. I mean, when we designed the world, we didn't want to keep it as a linear experience. Certainly, there are certain parts of the game which will be unlocked for you for, you know, narrative purposes and quest purposes. But I would say almost most caves, you know, you can stumble upon them, you can find the monster inside the cave without having taken the monster quest, you know, to take out the monster beforehand. So there's so much exploration to do there. We don't really like to keep it locked away for the player.
Yeah, if we do, it generally has like a narrative sense. So I feel like for Novigrad City, you have this impression where first time you go into this huge medieval city, it might feel a bit more locked down to you. But as you get to know more and more characters, make more acquaintances, they open up their doors to their houses to you. So the city opens up in a sense as you progress through the game. And here, I feel it makes perfect sense in the way.
Now, speaking on monster quests specifically, Are these type of encounters, do they happen dynamically? Does the environment or the time of day actually affect strategy or monster behavior when you tackle one of these?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. You have to pay close attention to what type of monster you're hunting to see what's its preferred. You know, does it have any weaknesses? Does it have any strength? And so on. So, you know, the classic example is always the werewolf, which is more stronger during nighttime. So maybe it's better if you go at a different time of day when it's a little bit weaker.
Or if you're up for the challenge.
Yeah, I mean, if a werewolf is too easy, you can always make it more difficult for yourself.
Now, these monsters, as far as finding out their strengths and weaknesses, is there a way in the game to actually research this? Or books to read or people to talk to or anything else?
Yeah. There you have this beast diary, book of knowledge. You collect and update as you progress through the game. So, for that, as a player, it's very vital to check that out. So once you know what type of monster you're tackling, to know and read up about it and study it. Because, you know, being a witcher is all about preparation. You know, you can go into a battle, throw your sword around and hope for the best, but really the odds are that you're going to die. Now, if you prepare, the odds are more in your favor.
Yeah, definitely. The creatures we have in the game, they can be very deadly, but there's many ways to prepare for fights. We're using, you know, our alchemy system to create different kinds of potions or oils or even bombs that can help you even out the odds a bit. So coming back to the werewolf, for example, there's a kind of, like, werewolves are known in our game to have like a really, really high regenerative ability. So you'll actually see their HP bar go up as you fight them, depending on the difficulty you choose, right? So using a certain kind of bomb, you can completely nullify this regenerative ability and hence make the combat much more easier.
Well, let's talk about one of my favorite things, boss characters. What makes them different from Monster Hunter, and are they in the dungeon or quest-based in the game?
They're quest-based, I would say, most of the time.
Yeah, I would say most of the time they are.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to spoil too much about the bosses in the game, but you won't really stumble upon them in the wild.
Yeah, it depends on if they're like the story-driven kind of bosses, like, I don't know, I don't want to give any spoilery example here. I do know that we have also the opposite effect, where basically we have some monsters that might appear as bosses first, but then really they also appear as regular enemies throughout the story.
Yeah, I think that will actually surprise players.
Yeah,
they're thinking like, oh my god, this griffin, it's a boss. No, actually it's not. Wild. You can come across it at any time.
Really. Yeah.
So the bosses we have in the game are far more, unique, maybe?
Yeah, unique in a way. Maybe like this kind of griffin is like a much stronger version because it's older. It's actually more experienced, but we didn't want to give the impression that, all right, there's one griffin in the world and you just killed it. Well, this world should feel alive and as such. Even the monsters, they have their own like ecosystems. And what I know of our encounter designers is that usually they place the monsters in the world in a way that it makes sense for them to be there. Like if you as a player encounter a griffin, and it might be a surprise to you, it should at least on second look be obvious. Like you going, oh, of course, this seems to be like a perfect place for a griffin to live for whatever reasons. Because it's more going into details. It's basically that we thought of how every single monster lives and behaves in their habitats, and we kind of try to reflect that in the environment.
Yeah, so if you pay attention to, as you travel through the landscape, and you see, oh, I'm entering somewhat a more swampy area, chances are there will be more drowners there. Chances are that you will come across some drowners there. So, you got to pay real attention to the type of area you're in. So you always prepared, or kind of when you learn what you come across where you are.
Yeah, I feel like the game in that sense, when you play it on the harder difficulties, can feel very punishing, but as you learn it, you get to a point where when you die, you don't ever feel like it's the game's fault, more of your clumsiness.
Okay.
Does that make
sense? No, it makes perfect sense.
I think we hit the nail with that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a pretty good spot of balance.
Well, since we're on that subject, you've talked about crafting and alchemy already. One thing that I've heard just from various people that have been excited about this game is the overwhelming feeling of having to do crafting and alchemy. What is there anything that you've done in the game to kind of get new players accustomed to doing that and get them on the right path of knowing when and how to actually start crafting and to use potions?
Yeah, definitely. So one thing we found initially is coming from Witcher 2 is basically that people would really save their potions. They might make them, but never really used them because they had, like, I don't know, 3 charges on them. And then they felt, oh, I might save it for this encounter. And, you know, then they say, oh, but maybe not. And then they wait, and never use their potion because they always save it for the next better opportunity, right? So the way we alleviate it is basically have an easy way to replenish potions. So now when you craft a potion, it's more like unlocking new toy, where you use the ingredients, you create the potion, you get a certain amount of doses, you can use them. But now, once you depleted your potions, you can use alcohol and meditation to recreate them and get back your entire stack for relatively cheap. And this, we found, encourages players to actually play with various potion combinations and go out and make these different kinds of potions.
Yeah, we got a lot of feedback from the fans after Witcher 2. Basically, a lot of the players didn't really use the crafting as much as we would have liked them to in the previous title. So we had to rethink of how to make it more accessible for more people and more enjoyable, I would say.
Yeah, because I would say that's the one thing I took from when I played Witcher 2 is I didn't craft that much. I relied more on combat than I did anything else. So looking at just some of the videos and everything I've seen so far with Witcher 3, it seems to be a big part of what you guys are trying to get across. So I'm just curious, as a Witcher 2 player, what's going to be my incentive? What's going to push me to want to actually start doing that more?
Yeah, for example, some of the most powerful items that we have in the game, they're actually made by crafting now. And generally, I feel like you'll find more crafting ingredients just roaming the world. And that's sort of the perk of having an open world. You get to place a lots of places where naturally the player will stumble upon ingredients. So it's not as hard to come by what you need. Ultimately, you can also go to a store and shop and just stack up on what you might need, all the last remaining things for your potion or armor that you want to do. On top of that, I would even say that we really try to do this split between offering different kinds of experience. So if you don't feel like using alchemy and crafting, you can go to the more story-driven experiences, like difficulty levels that we have. The easy or normal level are basically more for players that really just want to focus on the story and not have all these deep, deep RPG mechanics that kind of take away from that in a certain sense. However, if you're more of a hardcore player that really wants to find all the nuances of every of the RPG, like really take care of your equipment, really keep your character updated throughout the game, and, you know, focus on the gameplay aspects and the story alike, you can go on the harder difficulties, where you'll find that it becomes increasingly more mandatory and helpful to success.
Personally, for me, same for me when I was playing The Witcher 2. I didn't do much of the crafting. I usually bought my equipment. So for me, you know, as a player who don't do much crafting, I found myself doing a lot more crafting now when I'm playing The Wild Hunt. So this system fits perfectly for me.
It's fine, really. Like, we don't want our gameplay mechanics to get into the way of our story. Like, our story is really important to us, and all the different sub-stories we try to tell in the side story missions. But at the same time, we also realize that the gameplay should be complementary and support our universe and our, again, narrative. So we offer both options, really. This also reflects in the way we do, like, our UI design, I guess, in the sense that we allow the player quite a large like many options to customize their UI and ultimately their experience to their liking. You can turn off quest markers or on the minimap. If you really don't want to know what's in the world and just go freeform, you can turn off the location markers. But again, you don't need to. We even have like options for people that are more story-driven to actually enable most of these markers and have like a really guided experience, if you will, if they just decide to focus on the story.
This is Gamer Tag Radio. Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
All right. Hey, okay. Advertising time. So this week we got a new sponsor. We got Pro Flowers, and I really want to thank them for supporting our podcast. And with Mother's Day coming up, I'm sure everyone out there is scrambling thinking, man, I got to get my mom something. What am I going to get her? Well, we're here to tell you, go with Pro Flowers. They actually just sent us over some flowers right before we started recording this. Beautiful bouquet, reasonably priced. And for this week, Pro Flowers is offering our listeners 100 blooms with a free glass vase for only $19.99. Or make your mom's day extra special with a premium vase and add chocolates for an additional $9.99. Just go to proflowers.com and use the code GTR. Now, Danny, did you get Pro Flowers as well?
Yes. My girlfriend, I surprised her today. She got hers today. And I believe Pete Rock also sent it to his wife, and she was surprised. And she said that he is not in trouble tonight. So that's a good sign. We're supporting Pro Flowers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, I also want to put in there that Pro Flowers guarantees to be fresh and beautiful for at least 7 days. And, you know, the website is easy to use and makes buying a beautiful gift for your mom simple and quick. And remember, guys, Mother's Day is coming. So do not forget it. I believe it is May 10th. So take advantage of this offer. Pro Flowers, get that free glass vase for only $19.99 and use the promo code GTR. So go to proflowers.com, use the code GTR.
Paris, once again, you want to hear my update about Harry's?
Yes.
Well, last week I was saying that I was planning to subscribe fully and cancel my subscription from the other company because I felt that the sample that we got from Harry's, the blades are pretty smooth. I noticed the difference after I shave, and I use blades all the time because I'm bald, so I'm always, you know, shaving, you know, all the time. I know you're very picky with blades too, with shaving, right? But I think this is it. Harry's is legit, and I really, really like it. But you want to say anything about that, though, about Harry's?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I went almost 20 years without using a razor just because I worry about razor bumps so much. But because when Harry's decided to sponsor us and send us a sample, I decided, let me give it a shot. So I started using the razor, and I mean, it's been a smooth shave. It's been great so far. And I mean, since we've been doing this over the last few weeks, I've had some people hit us up offline like, hey, are the Harry razors really as good as you're saying? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Harry's is working great. I really like it. And while I have not done a full subscription yet, I'm pretty sure I'm going to go ahead and do that this week.
Yeah,
that's how
good.
Much I like the razor. You know,
well, here's really another thing I have to say, and this is legit. I purchased the first set, right? And someone from their company contacted me right away after I did that. And they were like, hey, any issues? Let us know. Like, I love the engagement with the consumers. I think that's very, very important from any company. So by their doing that, it was really cool. And I asked them a couple questions about the product and everything. So here's very quick. Shipping is free, and the blades go from their German factory straight to your door at the factory direct prices. So if you want, compare the prices that they have and other like retail stores from other products, and you see the difference. Here's a special offer for you guys, all the listeners out there. Go to harrys.com and enter the code GTR at checkout to get $5 off for a starter set. That's right, that's GTR, and you get a month worth of shaving for just $10. That's harry.com, code GTR at checkout, and change the way you shave forever.
Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
Well, my question is, what are some of the physical side effects of using too many potions, along with like the popular beard growth or any other physical changes that will happen over time?
Actually, you see it in Geralt's face. The more poisoned he gets by the, like, the higher the toxicity level, the more effects it actually has on Geralt's skin and face. You see, like, the veins with darker blood going through and him becoming much paler.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite a creepy effect, actually, you know, and because basically what you've done is when you reach the high toxicity level, when you're taking too many potions, you basically poison yourself. So you keep dropping health. So you need to take, what's the name of that? It's this potion. I forgot what its name is. The milk, some kind of...
It's the white honey.
Yeah, white honey potion to cancel the toxicity effect. So until you do, you will look like you're kind of OD'd on potions and keep dropping health. So you got to be careful with that as well.
The potion junkie. Yeah, I think, and then your vision becomes a clear bird. I think... I'm not sure on this one, but I think ultimately you die if you just go all the way overboard.
Does that mean that you have to, like, wait a couple of days to come back normal, or do you have to, like, do any other things to become normal again?
It depends on the duration of the potions you really take. Some potions, yeah, they last, I don't know, really long, but have super strong effects, and some are shorter lasting, very brief, that only, like, last for a couple of seconds, really, and... So basically you need to just wait until it wears off, and that can be increased by meditating ultimately, because meditating allows you to skip time essentially.
The latest gameplay trailer that you guys came out with, you had a hilarious scene where Geralt comes across a vampire and he asks, you know, what year it was, and he tells him to F off. So the question I have is, what's the balance of humor and actual drama in this storyline that you have going on here in the Wild Hunt?
Funny, I think they actually made an internet meme out of that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's a ton of them. It's hilarious.
We were actually, I was quite surprised on seeing the how much fun people were having with that. But in regards to the balance between drama and comedy and tragedy and so on, I think our story writers have done a really great job. So when you play the game, you will go through this whole emotional experience. You know, some moments will have this nice, dry, cynical sense of humor. It just leaves you laughing. Some moments will actually be quite upsetting without spoiling anything. And it's in the same style as... because these games are based upon... a book series from a fantasy book writer named Andrei Sapkowski, and his style of writing is very dry sense of humor. And our writers have really, you know, they grew up reading these and have really taken on the spirit of that and continue writing in this style.
Yeah. No, I'm not a writer, but I feel like what we've done is, you know, in order to appreciate the sad moments, you have to have some more light-hearted moments, right? Yeah. If you're constantly depressed or angry or whatever is going on, it sort of loses its novelty. You get accustomed to it. So whenever you have like this, what is it called, like comedic relief every once in a while, it prepares you, it allows you to be sad and angry again in a weird way. So I guess that's really important for us. And again, we're really deep about the story, so...
Let's talk about the DLC. We know that there's going to be a bunch of free content that's coming, and you've also announced the two expansion packs. My question mainly is on the free content that's coming out to all platforms. Can you kind of elaborate on some of the things that people can expect for that?
Yeah, it's going to be minor things that we didn't want to charge for, because it would be just insulting to charge for it. I think one of them is... beard and hairstyles.
Yeah, we have some cosmetic ones, but yeah, they also range to full blown out quests. So it's not like we're just going, all right, have these cosmetic tidbits, but it's a wide array of stuff really that you can expect from us.
And you know, if we didn't want to put them the 16 DLCs together and make you pay for it, because it's just 16 minor things, so it wouldn't really make any sense for us to charge for it.
Yeah, we still wanted to provide some goodies for the players.
Yeah, as a kind of reward for believing in us, in our product as well. You know, so it's kind of a way of saying thank you.
Cheesy, but we got like insane fan support for this one.
No, yeah, absolutely, absolutely, I'm definitely one of those fans. Talking about combat, are there any improvements to the combat system from Witcher 2 going into Witcher 3?
All right, definitely. We basically rewrote the whole combat thing from scratch. Took only the parts that we thought that were good, and from there on rebuilt it. Basically, we got a lot of different feedback from the community as to our combat system. And generally, what we found with the previous game is more like half-half. People love it or either hate it. And what we really noticed stuck out is that people want a lot more responsiveness. So that's what we focused on when creating this new combat system, is actually making it flow and react to whatever buttons you press. So basically, if you press a button, it translates into one action, and if you press another button, it will also do another action corresponding to what you press. And Witcher 2 was more like, you press a button, then you might be locked in this sequence of animations. This is not the case anymore. So we put a lot more control into the player's hands.
So I know the game is coming to Xbox One, PlayStation 4, and PC, and we already know that the console specs are already locked in. But can you tell our listeners who are planning to pick up the PC version, like Paris here, about the hardware requirements to play on ultra settings?
It's all online. The I'm not a hardware kind of wizard, though. It's all online in the specs that you need, the recommended and the minimum.
Well, let me rephrase the question this way. There hasn't been anything official online as far as ultra settings go for the PC version. We've seen some speculation. I guess a German website got to play it, and they mentioned they played it on ultra settings and kind of talked about the specs. I've actually, just so you guys know, I've recently just built a brand new gaming rig specifically to be able to play this on ultra settings. And the reason we're bringing that up is because you guys have been on record as saying that you're not showing off the ultra settings until the actual game comes out because you want people to experience it. So let's just kind of focus on that for a second. Why not show off the ultra settings prior? Is it really going to be that big of a leap that you truly want gamers to experience it for the first time for themselves versus on a video?
As we said, we're not really.
Right.
I mean, up until recently, we've still been optimization. We still are. You know, us. We're basically providing support way after the game launches. So that's definitely a reason for why we haven't talked about the specs for that.
Well, here's an interesting question, because I'm not a developer, but I'm curious. Like, were there any challenges while developing this game on different consoles, including the PC? Like, what were those challenges for you guys? If you
On our end, for level design, it didn't really affect our work that much, did it?
No. We wanted to make sure it was the same experience on all platforms. So really, with the arrival of the new consoles, it kind of made sure that we are not held back. And we can do the open world experience there is equal for all platforms. So for us, it's been a good thing, really, with this. And it really has been no compromises for us. A big thing for us in the location team has been that the world doesn't have many loading times. And it's, you can be deep in a cave somewhere deep in the south, mm-hmm. questing, and then just ride straight to the north into the major big city, and it won't be any loading times. And for us, that was really important to have that on all platforms, to have this kind of seamless experience.
Yeah, because it definitely enhances on the whole aspect of having an open world that is free for the player to actually explore. Now, what Jonas said actually remind me that, yeah, if anything, it was quite to the contrary. Because of the new consoles, but also the advances in PC hardware, we were actually able to keep a super high draw distance And speaking of level design point of view, that's really important for us because now we can see all these interesting spots in the distance. And not only do you always have something to do, always something where you can go to, but also it helps the player orient himself within the world. So if you see Novigrad in the distance, you can kind of gauge your relative position and know where you are, right? That's an aspect that actually we try to convey in most parts of the open world, where you should always be able to look around and see like at least one major landmark that you know and can refer to.
Another thing too that I want to know too is the voice acting for this game. How was the process on that? And is this the main character? Is this the same person that was in the previous Witcher games that did the voice acting for that? For that character?
Yeah, it's Doug Cockle. He's been with us from the start. And, we're, of course, happy to have him with us here now in the Wild Hunt as well. And in regards with the other voice actors, the process is also that when we shape the landscape, the people are shaped by the landscape and their accents and how they speak corresponds to that. So people will speak in different ways in different regions. So I think it's the writers who's in charge of that, to finding the right accents and right actors. It was quite a long process to establish that, but you will really feel it when you travel across the landscape, the difference of character that people have. And it's really nice little detail, at least for me.
You can definitely tell like the cultural differences within among the people that live in our world. If you go to Skellige, for example, you have more like, what is it, like a Scottish
Northern
accent?
I think Northern Irish.
Yeah, I'm not really good when it comes to accents. So I know it's that kind of accent. I will be slaughtered online by people for saying it like that. And then again, you have like the Nilfgaardians in our game have their very own accent. And again, if you go to Redania or Temeria, which are parts in our world, you get different accents. So actually for people that are even very familiar with the previous games, they can even like listen to the people and sort of make out from where they come. And that's something that's also picked up in this game story every once in a while.
Well, let me ask a more nerdy question here, talking about the environment. We've talked a little bit about the day-night cycle, but what about the weather system? Is that completely dynamic?
Yeah. I mean, you can't control the weather really in this game.
Like we can.
We're the developers, but as a player, I mean, you know, you have to keep track of the weather, especially if you're on a boat. I mean, you don't want to be on a boat on a stormy day. So, you know, keep track of that, for instance.
Yeah, and actually it goes like the dynamic weather is really cool in the way that it also affects the inhabitants of the world, if you will. So people you will find when it rains, they will actually go and try to look for shelter. When it's sunny outside, you'll see more people outside than when it's just like a cloudy, not so nice day. And that's the different ways people react. And also not only you get the weather, but also the time of day. People will do different things throughout the entire duration of any day. And if you follow them around, you will notice that.
Okay, one final question for me on the environment. Obviously, you have Roach, your horse, which you can call to your side at any time. But talk a little bit about the fast travel. So the fact that this world is just so huge, could you just go on a little bit of how fast travel is going to work in the game?
So you have to first discover location in order to fast travel from there. And you can't just fast travel from anywhere in the world. You have to go to a signpost and travel from the signpost to another signpost. And this way we keep in more control over how the player will use fast travel. And it makes more sense if you can fast travel from a crossroad to another crossroad or so.
Yeah. People have been worried about us, about fast travel not being necessarily like well enough, as in that they can constantly fast travel at their own will. But from our tests, if you will, with the hands-on events that we've had, we've actually experienced a lot of people felt about our game that we managed to actually design it that interestingly with so many different details that you are not really willing to fast travel under the premise that you'll feel like you missed something. So that was something that really was important for us, because you make such a huge world, you want the player to also go out and explore it. At the same time, we know that it can be quite exhausting to go these long distances. So we try to balance it between providing gameplay solutions to this longevity and also making it still interesting to just go by horse, or encouraging that kind of behavior.
Well, my last question is, were there any other games that inspired you guys to work on this game, on Witcher 3, that came out in the past?
That really depends on who you ask. Like every single person in the studio here will probably give you a different answer. And it's not even limited to games. Like, people, we get inspired by books, they get inspired by even music, right?
Yeah, paintings, you know, it's... We draw inspiration from a lot of things. So it's anything from, like, you know, you watch a film and like, oh, that's really cool, to, you know.
Yeah, it's like, it's also kind of the perks of being such a multicultural studio, that you have all these people with different backgrounds and experiences. They have all their own stories that they try to bring into the world one way or the other. And I guess that's what allows us to create so many fresh and unique experiences in the game.
See, like, to me, this game reminds me of a mature Zelda game, like, personally for me as a gamer, you know? So, yeah, I'm pretty excited. I'm very, very excited for this.
You know, I'm a big Zelda fan. Like, I bought a Wii U just to play the new one when it comes out. Like, that's how Zelda fan I am. And I wouldn't deny that it might have found its way in the way I design levels or locations. But I don't know if players would be able to tell when they play it, really. It's like, for example, if Jonas designs a dungeon, it might be entirely different from how I do it. So,
yeah. And on the subject of Zelda, I still dream about Wind Waker. I love that game so much. Yeah.
Yes.
Awesome. But, you know, awesome. I think one inspiration for me when creating the landscape has been Red Dead Redemption, in terms of how it feels when you travel across it. So that's been really.
That's pretty big. That was a fantastic open world game. So that's really good to hear.
So guys, you see, like, the range from Zelda to Red Dead Redemption, that's pretty large, and that's like just between the two of us. So. There's a lot of different opinions on this matter.
Yeah. All right, Paris, I believe we're going to end it right now. And, you know, I want to say thanks for, you know, taking your time to talk to us and everything. And, you know, I'm very excited for the game. Paris, he's excited. And anything else you want to say, Paris?
No, other than, so far from everything I've seen, you guys have made a fantastic game. I cannot wait until May 19th so I can get my hands on this. And just thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I can't wait for the game to come out myself.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
All right, so we're back. What a great interview. Shout out to CD Projekt Red. I had an amazing time recording this, and honestly, Paris, I am very picky, but I feel like this is one of my favorite interviews since the Phil Spencer interview, or even the Titanfall interview.
Oh, I would agree 100%. And again, just big thanks to Miles, Jonas, and Robert for you know, coming on and doing the interview with us and talking about The Witcher 3. Now, one thing I wanted to correct. Since we recorded the interview, there was the one question about the weapon leveling that they couldn't really answer because they weren't that aware of it. Well, just by chance, I happened to be on Reddit and I ran into Damien Monier. I believe that's how you say his last name.
Who's that?
Damien Monier.
Okay.
I believe that's how you say his last name. I apologize if I'm butchering it, but he is a senior game designer over at CD Projekt Red. And he's the one that was on Game Trailers Live that actually answered this question originally. So I brought up to him that we did the interview and that there was some confusion about the weapon leveling. And he confirmed that what it is the kind of, like they were already saying during the interview, the ultimate weapons, their level won't change. If that is like a level 25, level 30 weapon, that will stay what it is. And you need to get to that level to actually use it. But the other weapons in the game, yes, they will scale down to whatever your current level is and they will stay there. And basically, like he explained it to me offline, is it's not, you won't notice it while you're playing. You won't even know that this is an issue. So I'll just simply say, you know, we'll see when we're playing. It seemed like the Miles and Jonas didn't notice it at all while they were playing. And actually, this was a feature that was recently implemented into the game, so they may have just been completely unaware of it since it was a newer feature that just came out. So just want to clear that up. But again, thank you to those guys. Really appreciate the interview. I thought it was fantastic. It just got me even more excited to play the game. Awesome. You know, can't wait.
Yeah. Yeah, same here.
Which I think we actually have a voicemail on this very subject. So do you want to go and play that?
Yeah, let's play right now.
Fanmail@gamertagradio.com.
What's going on, Danny, Paris, Pete Rock, and Poston J? How you guys doing? Just had a quick question for you guys. Just wanted to get y'all take on this thing. I just read this statement that Microsoft had wrote saying that they apologize for the footage that was shown on The Witcher 3. The only reason why The Witcher really even got my attention was because Paris has been talking about it, saying that he was getting his PC together, getting a rig that could run it. But Microsoft, you know, they stated that that wasn't the footage from the Xbox One, but it was, in fact, the footage from the PC version running at 1080p and 60 frames per second. They also stated that, of course, the Xbox One version will run at 900p, 30 frames per second. But my question to you guys is, do you think that the resolution really matters that much? I mean, I understand that it does make a difference. I understand that some people have that preference, but because Microsoft has dropped the console down to $349.99, which is lower than the competitors, do you think that because of that, that could possibly make it okay for the Xbox One maybe not to be able to hit the same marks as the PS4 because it is the cheaper console on the market? Just wanted to get your opinion on that, guys. I'm sure people are going to crucify Microsoft for this, but even the people at Project CD said that it was in no way intentional for this to happen. So just wanted to get you guys take. Love you guys. You guys are incredible. Keep up the great work. Thanks a lot. You guys have a good day.
All right, so what do you have to say about that?
Okay, so we say this all the time, that the resolution, frames per second, doesn't matter really. If you own an Xbox One and you're having fun playing games on an Xbox One, knock yourself out. Doesn't matter, because the actual gameplay experience of The Witcher 3 will not change because the resolution or the frame rate happens to be lower than what it is on the PlayStation 4 or on the PC. Like I've said before, I talk about a PC all the time, and I built this ultimate gaming rig because I just want to experience The Witcher 3 at its ultimate highest settings. But the thing about it is, that's just me wanting to see shiny graphics and the high frame rate and all of the little effects that may not necessarily be able to be turned on a PlayStation 4 and an Xbox One. But the actual gameplay of The Witcher 3, the experience of the open world and everything that you can do in The Witcher 3, that's not going to change. So it doesn't matter. If it's 900p, 30 frames per second, it's going to be fine. And some of the if you search around YouTube and see some of the gameplay that actually is on the Xbox One, looks fine. Mm-hmm. You would never know. You're going to go, oh my God, that's 900p. You're not going to say that. You're just going to play it and you're going to have fun. So I think people get way too caught up in this whole resolution frame rate thing. It matters. If it matters to you, then go get the hardware that can actually support it. If it doesn't matter to you, get the system that your friends are on that you're going to have fun with. That's all it comes down to.
Well, I very quick, before we start reading the other emails, somebody also contacted us through Twitter, and he asked, hey, you know, I listened to, you know, last week's episode of GTR where you guys talked about Battlefront. And I think Pete was the one saying, hey, yeah, I'm going to buy PlayStation 4 console just for this game, you know. And a lot of people were asking, hey, should we just buy a PlayStation 4 for for Battlefront and forget the Xbox One version. First of all, we haven't seen the Xbox One version at all. So, but I look, I know if the developers are going to work on a game and it's going to be an all platform, they're going to go 110%, make it happen and make it work for that particular like console, because one thing they don't want is have a great experience on one console and the other one a bad experience, then it's going to be bad PR and the consumers are not going to buy based on that. So that will give them a pretty bad name for the company that worked on the title. I think that DICE, they worked really, really hard for all the consoles, including the PC.
Oh,
and the only reason, and the only reason why we're seeing the PlayStation logo at the end of the trailer is just it's a marketing thing. You know, it's we've seen this with Assassin's Creed in the past. They weren't PlayStation. Then this past Assassin's Creed was they have a special exclusive marketing deal with Microsoft. Destiny had the same thing, right, Paris?
Witcher is Xbox branded. Call of Duty traditionally has been Xbox branded. That's all just marketing stuff.
It's all marketing stuff. So doesn't matter which console, which version you buy, it's going to be the same game and same experience. The only difference is some is going to look a little bit better graphically, like Paris was saying, but the experience of having fun is going to be there. Totally.
Exactly. Now, to follow up on that, because we got an email as well just on the Battlefront thing. So let me jump into that because that follows along this. This is from Alex, and he said, just wanted to tell you I love the show and keep up the good work. My question is, the trailer in Battlefront says game engine footage. What does that really mean? That's not how the game is really going to look in gameplay to me. It looks like a tech demo, just like the game Aliens Colonial Marines. The demo looked awesome, but the final product looked like garbage. I'm just afraid that the game looks good now, but the final product may not look like anything the demo does. Well, like anything the demo does. Do you think that's a possibility? Just want to know your thoughts on that. And thank you. I'll answer this one and say that I saw a 30-minute gameplay demo.
Is it 30 minutes? Are you sure?
It was about 30 minutes. Seemed about 30 minutes. Let's put it this way. Forget the time. It was a nice long demo. I'll just say that. Don't put a time on it. I saw a gameplay demo with my own two eyes. Did I have hands on? No. But it was a gameplay demo. It was a multiplayer match on the PlayStation 4, and it looked like the trailer. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that's what it's going to be on November 17th. I am saying today in April 2015, it looks exactly like the trailer. Now, we also had some people on Twitter and everything during the week also question if that was really what Battlefront was going to look like. And like I said, I can only go by what I saw. I can only go by what DICE was telling me. I can only go by what Lucasfilm was telling me. And like I said, what I saw with my own two eyeballs. And right now, today, it looks just like the trailer. It does look that good. Now, have we been fooled in the past? Absolutely. Watch Dogs is a prime candidate of that. We saw those initial trailers. Looks nothing like that in the final product, even on the PC. But that's Ubisoft. That's that game. That has nothing to do with what Battlefront ultimately will be. Now, the suggestion I would give everyone listening to this, if you're skeptical and you're not 100% convinced it's going to look like that, don't pre-order the game. Don't buy it blind. Wait until the game comes out. Wait until you can see for yourself if it is exactly what you want it to be. If it's not, don't buy it. Yeah. It really comes down to that.
E3 will hopefully get some hands-on on this game. Because they're really going to push this hardcore to everybody. You not only the media, but retail too.
Well, I like it. Like we were kind of saying last week, I think the smartest thing that EA and DICE can do is just like they did with Battlefield Hardline. Come out at E3, talk about it, and then go, oh, guess what? We got a beta for everybody right now. And then you can download it and play it and judge it for yourself. Mm-hmm. That's the smartest thing they can do, in my opinion. So I really hope that's what they do. That way, it's not just us on the podcast telling you what we saw. It's not a video on YouTube, but you're seeing you actually in your home with a controller in your hand. You get to play the game. I really hope that's what they do.
You know, I feel that that EA should release that gameplay footage online as soon as possible, because there's a lot of people that still don't believe it. But it's cool. I understand. I don't blame you guys. You know, we've been fooled in the past, but I feel that this is it. This is the real deal. And maybe this is just an early build. Who knows? We might see even a better version once it comes out on November 17th. I mean, look, wait till they show more stuff, and we see the final product in November if you want to be just to be safe, you know. So, all right. So we have another question. This is from Carlos. Shout out to Carlos. Hey guys, love the podcast. Your was the first podcast I liked and started subscribing to, and now I can't imagine being without it. Oh, thanks, man. That was pretty cool. Anyway, I wanted to talk about Mortal Kombat X. I got so hyped for this game, I rushed out and pre-ordered it. And it's the first game that I ever pre-ordered. Okay, interesting. So far, I'm loving it. The graphics, the characters, and especially the gameplay have me hooked. It reminds me of a time when I spent endless quarters playing Street Fighter II on arcade and using Ken as my favorite character. So I was wondering, what is your guys' favorite all-time fighting game and character? P.S. I use GTR as my code for Harry's Razors, and I got my discount. Thanks. Well, first of all, Carlos, thank you for emailing us, and also thank you for using the code for Harry's. That will support us big time, you know, GTR. So thank you for that. One of my favorite fighting games of all time, I'm going to keep it old school. Personally, you know, I like the new one, you know, the Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat from now. But I feel that Street Fighter 2 is like my all-time favorite fighting game ever for me and personally. It just, I remember playing in arcade, but once they announced that it was going to be available for consoles, that we could play Street Fighter at home, that was like, what?
Yo, yeah.
On Super Nintendo? No. Yeah. Like, that was just like mind-blowing. And honestly, I was saying this back then. I was like, graphics cannot get better than this. Yeah,
I know, right?
Yeah. So that was pretty cool. And honestly, my favorite character out of all of them is Ryu. That's like all-time favorite character from Street Fighter 2. So, and I still use him for the current games and stuff. So, yeah. What about you, Paris? What was like your favorite all-time fighting game and character?
Yeah, it's Street Fighter 2 as well. I'll give just an honorable mention to Mortal Kombat. Like when you talk about the console thing, remember the whole Super Nintendo versus Sega Genesis thing? On the Genesis, you could...
it had blood.
Yeah, you could do blood, yeah. But the Super Nintendo, you couldn't. Thought that was funny.
Yeah, well, this is the bad part about the Genesis version. The controllers, there was not enough buttons, so you had to use the start button. Yeah. Yeah.
I know. But no, Super Street Fighter, Street Fighter 2 was mine. And yep. Chun-Li. All day, every day. Those legs, I was deadly with them. To this day, I can pick up a controller. I know all her moves. Just muscle memory.
Yeah.
I know how to do everything on her. Loved her.
Yeah, she's pretty dope, man. All right, so
Just real quick, forget the consoles. Take that to the arcade. See, these youngsters, I don't know what this is about. See, back in the day, I used to get on a city bus on a Saturday morning, go to Tyrone Square Mall, go to Aladdin's Arcade, and just play Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Street Fighter 2, all day. You have your quarters all lined up for who's next, and it was almost like just a tournament.
Yeah,
every weekend in the arcade, it was amazing. No, man, it was a good time.
Let me tell you this quick story. I was in New York, right? So I got all my cousins like, "Hey, let's go to the video store, the video rental store. Let's go there. They have Street Fighter 2. Let's just kick some butt." He's like, "All right, let's go." So we'll go. There's like a big mob of guys just there, you know, waiting to play, and I'll come get my quarter, put it on the side, right in the screen, like I'm ready, like, okay, I'm next, man. Yeah, it's like that vibe, dude. That was like a great time, man, to play arcade games, man. Just that, and people are like going crazy in the back watching two players fighting. Once it gets really, really close at the end, and if somebody wins, like, wow, congrats, dude. Like, it's pretty cool. I think that's a better experience than just home playing online, you know. So all right, so we have one more email. Paris, you want to read this one, the last one? This is Xbox One versus PS4 thing. I don't know.
Yeah, and he is from Poland, so I want to make sure I get this name right.
Okay, go for it.
His name is Jaroslaw. I hope I'm saying that right. I apologize, but he's from Poland. So actually, let me read the email. He's saying, "Hi, GTR crew. My name is Jarek." And he puts in parentheses, "Say it, Jarek. I'm Polish gamer living in England. Play games since Amiga 500. Woo. First console." Yeah, I know. He's old school. "First console was PlayStation 1. Since then, I've always liked consoles more. At the moment, I own all big and small consoles. Each one I love for different reasons. For example, Xbox One for friend and activity section, so I can check how many more zombies I need to slay to get achievements and percentages. Questions to all. What, and again, he's language barrier here, but he's saying what you love your console. What do you love your console, PC, or handheld for? Thanks for the GTR podcast. You guys are awesome. Gamertag, Yama PL. And PlayStation Network, he is PALACZ, because I refuse to try and pronounce that.
That's good. Well, can I start? Xbox?
Hey, we know you're gonna do Xbox.
Oh my god! Well, like, I have all the consoles, right? So with the Xbox, I love the same thing with the achievements and just the I believe the quality of the voice chat. I like that a lot. And I really like the part where you go to the game hub and you see like the leaderboards, and you could compare. Let's say you're playing, Battlefield. You see like who has the most kills, the most wins on the side, like a leaderboard from all your friends, which is cool. And also like with Forza, I do the same thing with that. And like I have the PlayStation 4. I love that console more, not because of online or playing with friends, but more because of exclusives. I feel that they have a lot of great exclusives that it's going to get my attention to play a lot of that console. Wii U, the same. I really don't like the online part of Wii U, but just the gaming experience overall with just all the games that they have, you know, especially like with Smash Brothers, Zelda coming out, who knows when, you know, little things like that. So that's my part.
Okay, well, this is going to sound like a cop out, but I got to go with the PC. Just for the diversity of everything. And I feel like Steam has come so far in its mimicking of what Xbox is doing on Xbox Live that, you know, I really like those features. I like the fact that there's Origin as well. I like the fact that I can do, you know, GOG on there as well. Just the diversity of games, everything. Obviously, all the messaging, all that stuff that comes with PC gaming. But if we're talking consoles, actually, honestly, I'd go Xbox. I just think everything. Oh, my God.
Wow. Microsoft is calling you.
Whoa. Microsoft. Hey, you better talk about some Xbox. No, but I mean, Xbox Live set the standard for everything that we do with online gaming.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'll always stick with that. Yeah. You know, when it comes to consoles, that would be my number one reason for always going back to an Xbox console. Now, like I've said in the past, I think PlayStation is starting to catch up to that, but they're still not 100% there.
Mm. But it's a great console, though.
No, great absolutely. Well, look, I mean, like I said, if I had to choose one and one only for a gaming standpoint, I'd still go PlayStation 4 right now. Now, as far as the Wii goes, just the nostalgia of being able to play Zelda and Mario and Metroid and those type of games. But beyond that, they got a long ways to go to catch up with the rest of them.
Yeah, definitely, man. All right, Paris, we're going to wrap it up because this is a pretty long episode.
Oh, yeah.
Very long episode. But look, you know, I really want to get your feedback about this interview. Do you liked it or not? Just tell us everything. And, you know, you could either go on Facebook, Twitter, fanmail at gamertagradio.com, or call us to 786-273-7GTR and let us know your thoughts, man, because I love getting feedback from our listeners every week. So and tell us where you're from. You know, I can't guess where a lot of people... when they email us, I can't guess where they're from, you know? So very important. That's it. I think that's it, Paris.
Yeah, I think that's it.
All right.
Thank everybody for tuning in again this week. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. So make sure to listen and stay tuned for next week. We'll be back with the whole crew, hopefully. So, all right. Next week, we out. Peace.
You're listening to Gamertag Radio. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week.